Hello and welcome to The Great Game, an Australian mega game podcast. I'm Jack.
And I'm Patrick.
And this is episode 10, our league debrief. We're going to be chatting through our experiences of this super ambitious and exciting two-week mega game with the members of our team. That's Zach, me and Patrick, the designer Stefan, and Ed from a bunch of different mega game groups who was part of the team that, spoilers, won the whole tournament. So that'll be super exciting. Just some announcement first, though. So West Coast Mega Games have announced Project Nexus. They've released a Patreon for this one, which is a digital solution for managing mega games. So the idea, they've released a pilot for Watch the Skies, and the idea is that you'll be able to track the tech tree, the clock for the game, team budgets, income, all this kind of stuff through this digital solution. I'm really interested to see where this goes. If you're interested in checking this out, check them out on their Patreon.
Also coming up, some big news in the mega game world is online Mega Game Con, or OMG Con, which is soon approaching. It's only a few weeks away, actually, from launching this episode, and it's in September. This is being put together by the Mega Game Coalition and a whole bunch of international collaborators. It's a three-day online convention using all kinds of mediums like Zoom and Discord and whatever else might happen. They're going to be running through online mega games themselves. They're going to be doing some playtesting. There's going to be social deduction game sessions online with people all around the world. There's going to be some seminars, talks about mega games and their history and where they're at now, and kind of the work people are doing in the world of mega gaming. There's going to be a watch party where people can all tune in to watch the original Watch the Skies videos. And there's even going to be some interviews with us. So check out the link below. It's dirt cheap to attend. It's going to be a lot of fun. It doesn't align very neatly with the Australian calendar, but hopefully a lot of that content will still be available after the con. So definitely check it out.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm super excited for that one. I'm continually amazed by how much mega game stuff is happening, even through COVID and everything else. It'll be awesome. Final announcement is that we Mega Game Assembly... we'll also be doing a podcast during OMG Con, and they're particularly looking for feedback from everyone about mega game ticket prices, which they'll be discussing during the podcast. So if you're interested and you want to check that out, check out the Mega Game Assembly Facebook page, and they've got a survey just asking questions about, you know, what kind of prices people are normally charging, all that kind of info, which they'll be discussing during the con.
And with all that news digested, it's time to get on with the episode. So as Jack said, we were talking about our league in this episode. We previously mentioned our league and ran through the design of it in episode 7. So by all means, jump back and have a listen to that if you haven't already. This time we sat down with Stefan, the designer, but also Ed from a whole bunch of UK mega game groups, and Zach rejoining us from Brisbane Mega Games. And we ran through a real sort of gritty, down to the details look at the game itself, how it ran over 2 weeks, and what the experience was like for the designer and the control, as well as the players in different teams. So with all that said, let's get into it. All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. I thought before we jumped into the discussion, we could just do a quick whip around to make it clear who's here. There's a lot of us on the call. So first up, I'm Patrick from the Sydney Mega Gamers.
Hi. Yeah, I'm Zach. I'm from Brisbane and was on the same team as Patrick and Jack.
Yeah, and I'm Jack from Brisbane Mega Games, and I was playing as the Liege in this team, the Quebec City Nine Stars.
And I'm Stefan Salvacruz. I'm the designer and creator of the Owl League.
I'm Ed Silverstone. I'm part of a couple of different UK mega game groups, and in this game I played the Hand of the Cardiff Dragons.
Excellent. So we've got a full house. We'll try not to speak over each other. And we are all here to talk about the Owl League, which was an online fantasy sports mega game from you, Stefan. Did you want to just start it off by giving us a real elevator pitch that you've probably mastered at this point about what the Owl League is thematically and sort of narratively?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Owl League, I think, like you said, is the best way I've put it is that it is a, quote, fantasy sports mega game. So it is a mega game where you take the role of a part of a sports team, but that sports team is in a modern fantasy setting where the game kind of plays like a unique mix of, you know, modern esports games and a little bit of modern sports, and then takes in all of those elements that you'd get from a standard fantasy sports game like fantasy football or fantasy basketball, baseball, where you trade players and manage your team lineup and, you know, play matches against other opponents in the league while still trying to do kind of the higher level stuff that you would find in, like, say, a football manager sort of game where you're trying to manage, you know, money coming in and various other aspects of the league in a broader context. But yeah.
Awesome. Okay. That's very succinct. And it's exactly as it played out now that we can all look at it in retrospect, I think. So for people listening, you could also jump back and have a look at episode 7 that we put out a few couple months ago, which was just prior to the game beginning. And we did run through with Stefan how the game was built and what the purpose was. So it's going to be interesting to compare these two conversations. I guess before we really get into a lot of the nitty-gritty, Stefan, I have a few questions about how it all ran for you, but just to kick it all off, how are you feeling now that it's all wrapped up? What was it like for you?
I mean, 2 weeks out, I definitely feel a lot better now that I've gotten some sleep and been able to, like, think back on it a bit more long term. So overall, I think for me, I think the experience has been definitely very, you know, interesting, and the feedback I've been getting so far has been fairly positive. So I'm glad that, you know, people have expressed that they've had a good time. So
yeah, awesome. That's great.
It's great to hear. Just for any of our listeners who didn't catch the previous episode, sorry, I should mention that Owl League was a 2 week long asynchronous game.
That's right. Yeah.
So that is one of the things that I mean, so one of the things we talked about when we ran this type of game with Dark and Stormy Nights just for 3 days is that we were really surprised by the stress of it and, like, the amount of emotional, I don't know, well, not necessarily emotional toll, but, like, how much work it is and how much stress it felt to have this thing going on in the background throughout our daily lives, even just for 3 days. So for 2 weeks, is that something you felt as it was going on? Did you find it, like, was it a stressful experience, I guess, or how'd you find it?
I think the long and short answer of that is yes. It definitely, you know, I think the first week was a lot of managing, you know, first setting up expectation with everyone, but also managing a couple of, like, technical glitches with the app and just with game flow overall. So in that way, you know, the 2 weeks were good because then that gave me the time to make sure that certain aspects of the game that were messed up or the certain aspects of the tech that were messed up were able to be resolved within that week. And then the second week was just trying to, like, get everyone moving towards the end, the goalpost, if you will. So
I've got a few, like, questions about how it all ran because I'm really, really curious after seeing it from the player perspective. But before we jumped into those, I just wanted to maybe ask the other three here. What were your roles in the game as players, and what did it, you know, in it, what's a day in the life for how those roles ran?
Yeah, so I was the head sage for the Quebec City Nine Stars, which, in terms of the actual game itself, involved me handling Two major parts of the game. First of all, the team roster and lineup for the Ludomancy matches, as well as the training schedule for the magicians or players on our roster. Sort of coming into it, I was expecting that it would be something where I would jump on frequently or regularly, submit team orders for matches, and then watch players get trained and see how the matches go.
Yeah, and on my side, I was the liege or lord, which was kind of the owner of the team, the person with all the money. I was in the parliament for the game, which were a bunch of people who were voting on rules for how the game worked and rules for the next season of the game, which was an interesting aspect that I think we'll talk about at some stage. But yeah, it was a role-playing focused council role with a lot of and with also money management and that kind of thing.
I was playing the Hand on a different team, the Cardiff Dragons. The Hand also had sort of two parallel roles. The first was sort of hiring and firing, including trades with other teams, and the second was this sort of slightly more ad hoc role of managing quests, which could look like anything from a search for an ancient treasure to appearing on TV for a publicity stunt. The game sort of started out quite heavily focused on trades, I guess, and then gradually as it progressed, my time pivoted more towards quests and narrative and that side of things.
Yeah, I was also the Hand on the same team as Zach and Jack, and pretty sure the first thing I did was embark on a quest that was to spend millions and millions of dollars on feeding birds. So it was a stumbly start for us, but it was an interesting role. Right, so that was sort of the what the game looked like mechanically, or at least the actions we were taking and engaging in that narrative. Stefan, I wanted to ask you if you can. I'm not sure if you can do this in a succinct way, but what did a day in the life look like for you? And I think it's probably a good time to mention that there were kind of on and off days for the game. How did that cycle work, and what were you actually doing to make this run?
Yeah, so on a high level, like you said, the way the game worked was that we would have match days on one day. So we started on a Saturday. Everyone submitted their actions at the end of the night, Eastern US time. And then that would then come to me and the control team to adjudicate some of those actions. So at the beginning of the game, a lot of the stuff was very manual. So having to adjudicate the matches was still a little bit manual in terms of, you know, validating that the code was right with looking at how the matches were meant to be run and scored. But over time, that actually got automated to the point where I could have it basically with the click of a button, it would show the match results. So as we got on, there was a little bit of a quicker turnaround with the different items. But more or less, you know, me and the control team were taking all of the information and setting up responses that would be ready for the next day. And so early on, that was a little bit of kind of that, you know, early mega game player wrangling where we're trying to tell people, okay, you have nothing to do on Sunday. You can take a break and then come back on Monday and get right back into it. So that was a little bit of the back and forth where a lot of it was just, you know, player communication, trying to make sure everyone's on the same page within that first week. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. And you were saying there that some of those actions that you were taking day to day, slowly as the game went by, they became automated. Was that by design or by necessity, or did it just happen that way? How did that come about?
It was a mix of both. So a lot of the game certainly wouldn't have been possible without the automation of kind of the spreadsheet magic that we were doing in the back end. And there were just a handful of things that are, you know, when it comes to spreadsheets that are just They can do a ton of things, and it's like the limitations of spreadsheets are kind of funny but awkward in terms of managing mega games. And one of them is just randomness, right? So one of and that's a like key component of Ludomancy, is that there's like a portion of randomness where a die roll is given that could either raise or lower your team's like overall power. And so for a while that was all manual. I would be like, you know, in front of my desk with every match and just rolling dice. And so I had to figure out a way. At some point I was just like, okay, I'm going to figure out a way to do this randomization in-house, and you know, just find better workflows for control overall. So in some cases I had set up a spreadsheet workflow to take the data from the app and then send it to a separate spreadsheet for us to adjudicate. And while getting the data was good, it was all kind of just raw data. So it was awkward at first until I took more time to be like, okay, this is how this workflow looks a little better from the control side. These are the different sets of data I need to pull in order to like speed up this control process. And so that took a little bit within that first week.
Yeah, intense. Awesome. How many control people did you have on the team running it?
Yeah, so we started with three, and it kind of like called down to me and Peter, who is one of the Mega Game Coalition folks. And that certainly, in retrospect, I would have liked a bit more control folks. And I think it was just a bit awkward with the timing of, you know, making sure control is around basically for the 2 week period.
I was also going to ask about the like the hours a day that went into managing this thing, but I think a more interesting question is probably, did you have any other life happening during the game? Or was it all encompassing?
I mean, outside of my regular day job, probably not too much. A lot of it was really, you know, standing in front of my monitors and taking a look at, you know, what's happening today, trying to keep track of everyone's progress, making sure the app is running correctly and everyone's able to enter their information correctly. So, yeah, I'm sure my wife could say the same thing.
So. Yeah. No, we should get her on next time to suss that out. And I just wanted to ask, because the interface with the game was very heavily, I mean, it was the app, which is essentially a pretty sexy front end to a lot of Google Sheets. And then there's the Discord, which is where most of the action happened, with people talking and making deals and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
How was your time split between Discord sort of answering questions and making sure people are happy and administering the back end of that app?
I would say it transitioned from, it was probably, you know, 90%, you know, maybe 80-20 on the app, and then, you know, helping folks out on Discord. And then within the first week, and then that probably transitioned after the second week once the app was a bit more stable. So Peter was doing a lot of that management of just, you know, actions that only happened in the app, like trading. You know, he was doing that and then answering questions from time to time, while any questions that were like directly related to the app or say matches where folks were like, hey, this, you know, this doesn't look right with one of the matches, can you take a look? That was most of where my time was in that first week.
Awesome. I just wanted to say, not really a question, but the app was absolutely beautiful, super slick. And the videos in the opening ceremony introducing each team with an animated logo were absolutely amazing. The whole graphic design and production of the game was really stunning.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, the app definitely, you know, I was glad with how it kind of visually laid out all the data. I think there was a lot of difficulty with some of the data entry, especially with the matches. I know a couple of sages were seeing a couple of issues trying to get the magicians on the right path and things like that. But yeah, I'm happy overall with how the app looked, and you know, I'm glad that everyone was able to see those introductions for folks. So we have that on the Magic Coffee House YouTube channel for folks to see if they want. Yeah.
Yeah, awesome. We'll definitely link to those. They were really impressive, and even I think none of us from the Aussie team, or from this Aussie team, I should say, I don't think we got to either of the ceremonies, but they were awesome just to look at anyway and get like the post ceremony vibe.
Yeah. And we'll have there'll be a post ceremony video also on that channel where, you know, one of the amazing things was the, West Coast Mega Gamers who were playing, you know, kind of just of their own volition started making, like sports casts, radio sports casts of their matches, which was incredible. They were posting them almost, you know, as soon as they were completed with their matches. And so we asked them, you know, by the end of the season, like, hey, would you cast for the finals? Which they were happy to do. And so we're going to be putting that to video. And so we got maybe about half of that to video, and the rest of it will be hopefully finished soon, and then we'll get that on the YouTube for everyone to watch.
Amazing. That sounds awesome. I think that's something we can delve into a bit later on, how invested some of the people got in this game and the narratives they created and some of the content they created. It was really, really cool.
Yeah.
I wanted to swing over to the players briefly and just talk about sort of what your expectations were before the game started, how you thought the game was going to play out versus how it ended up going, and how you expected the story to progress, and then, you know, how you actually saw it.
Yeah, so I had some experience both helping run Dark and Stormy, but also on a very different sense, as a player in a cricket fantasy sports management game. And so I wasn't really sure what kind of, coming into it, I wasn't really sure what sort of end this would be on, whether it would be similar to the mega game style that we had for Dark and Stormy, or whether it would be closer to the fantasy sports management game that I had been a part of. And with that, the story that I was somewhat expecting would have been across a season of play, taking a mid to lower ranked team, training, swapping players, and trying to work your way up the ladder would have been what I was expecting. To an extent, that's pretty much what happened. The other things that I was expecting, there wasn't too much expectations that I had. I think I was quite looking forward to finding out how it would work out. I thought the fantasy magician side was really, really interesting, and I was excited to find out how that ends up going.
Yeah, I really didn't know what to expect at all. Like, I mean, I've never played in any kind of fantasy sports kind of situation, and to be honest, I read basically my intro to the game was I read some articles on the website about how the game was going to work and didn't understand them at all. So I was going in like, all right, we'll see how this works. I was really just completely just seeing how it was going to work as it happened, basically.
There we see the distinction between a sage and a liege.
Yes, well, you know, I can pay other people to understand the sport for me.
wait, I was meant to get paid? Was that something that was...
So for me going into the game, I think My expectation was something much more sort of mechanically centered than what transpired. So the information on the website detailed quite clearly a fairly simple set of rules, which nonetheless led to some quite interesting consequences and some interesting choices. And even pre-game, myself and the sage for my team had spent a while talking through those rules, trying to sort of understand how they might lead to different strategies in practice. What I hadn't expected was the level of narrative depth and narrative richness within the game. So I was fully prepared just to spend a while spreadsheeting things up and then sort of meet back every other day to recalibrate our model and select an optimal strategy and then sort of disappear again. But yeah, as I'm sure we'll go on to discuss, what turned out was something with quite a rich plot and a rich universe, as well as an interesting sports game.
Yeah, I think I had a similar experience with expectations versus reality with you, Ed. I wasn't really sure what to make out of the role that I was in. I was a hand as well, but I was not expecting the kind of lore and world building that ended up happening organically through it and what was already given to us from day one. But I wasn't the mechanical side of things for the hand, which we can talk a bit more about, wasn't quite what I had thought it through. But that being said, like Zach said, I wasn't 100% sure what it was going to be. I was pretty open-minded. So I thought we should maybe run through the different jurisdictions of the game, like the mini games. And I've broken them down into four main areas. So I thought maybe we could talk through each one and have the people who interacted with them most. The main thing I wanted to kick off on was the Ludomancy matches. So that's maybe something for you, Zach and Stefan. Zach, how did you find that whole world? I mean, I'm in a similar boat as Jack, where I did not learn the rules of Ludomancy, and I was taking your advice the whole way through on what was good and bad for our team, which I feel like was the relationship we were meant to have, but in retrospect, maybe I should have learned a bit more. But how did you find learning that game and then how it actually ran?
Well, so the fact that you, I guess, the fact that my team left the understanding of the game to me showed really well. We did a really, really well, good score of winning one match and losing the rest. So
we did end up sadly with a 1-win, 7-loss record.
So maybe leaving it to me wasn't the best idea, but hey, how did the Ludomancy matches unravel? Well, it took me a little bit to work out. We weren't, we were in a bit of a weird time zone, so we missed the first day where friendly matches happened and then game one happened. But once I got to sit down and sit with a spreadsheet and work out what had actually happened, how the scoring worked and sort of the mechanics behind some of the more fiddly things that happened, I understood how the game worked. And from there, the matches sort of worked out how I was expecting them. Unfortunately, how I expected the matches to work out really wasn't how I wanted the matches to work out. I did find that the sort of matches did end up becoming, at least for us, it either a coin flip, which we lost more than we won, or weird situations where, due to tiebreakers, one team could force a win or a high percentage win, regardless of what the other team did. Both of which, on the losing side, was disappointing to go through, but on the winning side, you felt like you did something right. So, yeah, that's how I kind of felt that the Ludomancy matches ended up unraveling.
Hmm. Yeah, and on my side of that, I'll mention we were having quite a lot of strategy discussions all throughout the thing, and I slowly began to grasp the rules. I think in some of our discussions, you mentioned I didn't realize how much intensity you could devote to thinking about these matches and to thinking about the game, And in some of these discussions, you mentioned like you're spending like 4 hours crunching numbers on some of these matches. And from what I saw, that didn't seem to be necessarily uncommon among some of the sages, is to spend that amount of time and that amount of thought and intensity planning out how things were going to go. So that was a huge surprise to me, I think.
I mean, it's interesting to Zach's point that sort of every match seemed either to come down to a coin toss, or one team had the opportunity or found a strategy which guaranteed a win. I think that's a sort of an artifact of having each match be a sort of a single complex decision made up front, in the sense that because there's no points in the match to reevaluate and adjust your strategy or anything like that, that's almost inevitable. Like, there's one decision made, and either you found a strategy which guarantees you the win, or you found a strategy which is vulnerable to certain opposing plays, and you're just waiting to see how it comes out. There was maybe a tiny bit more nuance to it, in the sense that you could go through potential strategies for your opponents, look at how likely they were to succeed, and either sort of rule them out or sort of move them up and down the probability of being played. But at the end of the day, yeah, you are always gambling with what strategy your opposing team selected, unless you were lucky enough to have found a strategy which guaranteed a win, which we were twice, I think, in a position where we were sending a team in knowing we couldn't be beaten. But out of, 11 matches for us, that's still, not a bad ratio.
Yeah, definitely. I think we should note that that Ed's team of the Cardiff Dragons did win the championship. I think that's probably...
Yeah, so we've got a real diversity of perspectives here. We've got the 7-time absolute losers of the match, and we've got the championship winners, so that'll be good.
Yeah. So there's one person in this call that you should be listening to, and then don't worry about the rest of us.
Yeah, don't take any strategy tips from me, definitely.
Stefan, how does all that sit with you, that sort of... Those views on the game, is it how you expect it? Or I guess to start with, is this the kind of feedback you've received from others?
Yeah, definitely. I think there is an interesting... So I'll start with like the broad team aspect of understanding ludomancy. In a lot of ways, that kind of was the purpose of how sports teams kind of work in real life, and also how... I kind of hoped folks would be taking it. If you're a hand and you're really interested in learning ludomancy, that will help you some. But really, it's going to be a communication between your sage and yourself to try and determine how to build out your team, right? And same with your liege, in terms of how much money should I be investing in a certain player, or investing in other aspects of the game. So in that aspect, I think that happens a lot, and is kind of, especially with lieges, right? Owners are a lot of the time the folks at the table when it comes to hearing out the commissioner and hearing out like the league office's like decision to make rule changes. And so that happens, I see that happen more often than not with, at least from my perspective, the exception of like say the NBA, where there's a much more rigid structure of like coaches coming in to also help manage all of these major league changes. But so on the higher level, that's kind of how it's meant to look, is that the lieges are really concerned about money, the hands are concerned about the team overall, and then the sages themselves have to like work with what they got basically to try and make wins.
It was interesting to me how rapidly different teams developed sort of practical internal hierarchies.
Yeah.
So narratively, the liege is in charge; they're the owner, etc. But there were definitely some teams where the sage was calling all the shots. There were definitely some teams where the hand was calling all the shots. But As a hand, it was never entirely clear how true that was, because obviously it's a perfectly valid negotiating strategy to sort of play good cop, invisible bad cop, and say, oh, well, you know, I'd love to make a deal, but my sage wants something better. But yeah, I got a pretty strong impression that there were definitely some teams where the strategy was very much led by the liege and their desire for, you know, reputation and significance. Some teams where it was very much led by the sage and their desire for mathematical perfection.
Definitely. And while we're talking about like some leeches, present company accepted being out of touch with the rules of the game, I think it's worth mentioning that at some point, now I don't know, again, I didn't speak directly to some of these players, so I don't know exactly what was going on here, but there did seem to be some resistance to, there was a movement, and at one stage there was a head sage manifesto being circled around, where some head sages seemed to be disgruntled with the parliament changing the rules to ludomancy without fully understanding the ramifications of those rule changes. And there's some suggestion that Zach passed on where people were like, well, maybe we'll go on strike, or we'll like deliberately injure players or something until they let us unionize. Like all these ideas. Is that something that either of you, Stefan or Ed, had much more interaction with?
So it's actually interesting from my side. In terms of unionizing of the sages, a lot of that was more or less hearsay on the control aspect. Like, I don't think I saw a document of that level of detail that you're implying, Jack. But it was, yeah. I think that was something that was to be expected in some regard, and part of it for me was kind of trying to let it play out and see how the sages collectively would want to manage that, right? Because I think there are different sets of players where some of the players might be like, yeah, I really want to get more involved in politics because that would give me a more direct line as a sage to help adjust the game in my favor, or in a lot of cases just help adjust the game to be in a more equitable spot for everyone. So that was, in general, that was something I appreciated of most of the players, is that there wasn't really a search for being overly disruptive using parliament and any rule changes. So a lot of people were being very considerate of that. The other half of that, of course, is that some head sages really didn't want anything to do with politics, right? And so they wanted to just say, okay, this is the game I'm playing, this is the game that I'm going to play for the next 2 weeks, and that's that. So I didn't want to force that on folks and say like, okay, well, now all the head sages have to both do their rosters and go to all these parliament meetings to make sure things are cool. I think that was just general overhead. So folks that wanted to do that, or if there was a desire for that to happen amongst all the sages, then certainly we would try and accommodate that.
Yeah. So we were quite lucky in having the liege on our team. So as I've alluded to, the sage on our team and myself are out of game friends, known each other for a while. The liege was unknown to us, but he was very consultative. You know, things would come up in parliament and he would come back to us, ask our opinions, ask for our suggested approach, ask what way would we suggest he voted, both to benefit the team and to benefit the game as a whole, take that feedback and go off with it. And I think I don't know whether that was or wasn't going on to greater or lesser extents in other teams, but the impression I got was that maybe some sages felt cut out or unrepresented in Parliament, and that was where the sort of talk of a union came from. But yeah, it's hard to know exactly without having been sort of on those teams.
I do have a quick question for you, Stefan, if you don't mind.
Yep.
And this might be something that we talk on in maybe more detail slightly later, but was there a fear or concern that if the sages did collectively decide that, no, this is how ludomancy works and you guys can't change that, was there a fear that the lieges, the lords and ladies of ludomancy, would their role would be relegated to something that only exists for next season?
Yeah, that definitely had a, you know, that definitely was a consideration, especially because the lieges have such a, you know, their main game really is that council room. So adding more people to that definitely would change the dynamic pretty significantly. In terms of how it, you know, it was a really fine line to try and ride. That was difficult, not just in this aspect, but in a lot of different places. But the hope kind of was to allow for a level of disruption or a level of like game changing within the lieges that would make it impactful to the league as a whole, which I know is not necessarily the, you know, what would happen in, say, real life, right? If we were making like rule changes, we certainly wouldn't want to make those rule changes. Most leagues wouldn't want to make those rule changes mid-season. But that was part of the design, both like both game design wise and mechanically, to try and allow for a level of dynamic change that could be made possible through, you know, liege actions. So you know, I think one of the things like a lot of folks were looking at, say, like salary caps and things like that, but we also, the game on the back end itself could be as dynamic as saying like, all right, we want to completely change the points of the game. So today the points are 3-2-1 for the different gems, and tomorrow we're going to make it 5-2 and, you know, -1, I guess, if we wanted to. But that was, you know, that was something we wanted to allow for, a dynamic level of, you know, either addition or restriction for different liege rules, and then kind of go from there, which I think has, you know, seeing it play out over these 2 weeks definitely has a different perspective now.
So what struck me as fascinating in the liege game was the fact, and we've sort of drifted onto the parliament game, I guess, naturally, the number of players who had sort of either made a predetermined choice based on the briefing they'd read, they were good actors or bad actors. So there were some players who were definitely coming into it going, right, my role as a liege is to be devious, it's to be underhanded, it's to manipulate the rules of this game to give my team an unfair advantage, and anything I do to that end goes. And there were others who'd equally looked at the same briefings and come away with the mindset of, okay, my role as a liege is to just do what's best for the game, make sure my team's interests are represented, but basically, you know, bat straight, play fair, look after the interests of everyone, and make sure that this game is fun, engaging, even keel for everyone. What struck me as particularly fascinating was, I mean, that did lead to some clashes, which I suspect we'll get on to, where that difference of expectations sort of surprised some people. Some moves made by some people seemed out of the blue for others, but I think it was interesting most of all that by the end of the season, most of those people who'd come in with the intention of being sort of devious, cunning, pseudo bad actors had backed off. I felt that the sort of there's an interesting piece of game theory there that either the number of good actors or the nature of the game or a bit of both had led generally to a universal attitude being adopted of, okay, the lieges are here to do what's best for the game and best for the kind of teams as a group rather than to selfishly look after their own interests. And I think it could easily have gone the other way as well, with a slight sort of difference in sort of mechanical structure, a slight difference in the number of people who read the brief one way or the other. But it was fascinating watching it unfold, and I was glad to be able to watch it from the sidelines.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, because I actually found I had a very different experience, I think, and perhaps some of this is the time zone factor. But I was very surprised going into it and chatting to a lot of people in Parliament that it felt like everyone I was chatting to, that everything was extremely friendly and conflict-free at the start of the game. And reading the briefing, you know, in the briefing it doesn't specify that one specific other team is like your rival, like you might see in some other mega games. The briefing didn't seem to suggest that any particular team was going to be villainous or anything. So we started out being very friendly, and the people I talked to mostly were also doing the same. And I was like, wow, this is one of the most conflict-free mega games I've been a part of, at least at first. And when we started losing, we were like, all right, what are we going to do here? And we started thinking about going heavily down the villainous path. We had a bunch of ideas. One of the ideas we were going to do is that I was going to create a corrupt ethics committee, which would be rigged to find ethical problems with the star players of all our opposing teams.
Amazing.
We had a lot of ideas like that, but we messaged Stefan and the moderators about villainous stuff like that, and got the message that wasn't really an intended part of the game. And so from there on in, we did end up going full friendly, basically.
I think it's important to note that those conversations happened after the first match.
So when when we started losing after the first
match. Right. Love it. We've lost one match, complete face heel turn, done.
Yep.
I'm going to move us on because I don't want to get too bogged down, but there's a lot to talk to. And there's one important thing there that we mentioned, which was next season, which I really want to dig into. But before we do, I just wanted to go over a couple of the other mini games and jurisdictions, one being the quests. Ed, did you want to speak to that a little from your perspective? I had a certain experience with them, but how did they go from your experience, sort of how they were sold to you and then how they actually played out?
Yeah. Oh, wow. I loved the quests. I think the first maybe 3-4 days of the game, I barely looked at them. I just sort of went down the list of pre-prepared default quests, picked one that looked all right, and then went back to, you know, trading and planning for matches, because that was absorbing a lot of time, especially early doors. But then Peter came and gave us a bit of a narrative hook in terms of the dragon that lives under Cardiff, because everyone knows there's a dragon living under Cardiff, sort of having a bit of a midlife crisis and sort of that causing various earthquakes and stuff in the Cardiff region, and everyone looking to us as sort of the local concentration of magically talented individuals to find a solution to this. And that was fantastic work on Peter's behalf. And like from then on, basically every one of our quests became with one exception, I think, became a part of this gradually emerging narrative about like sort of ways to help our dragon reach out into the wider world of draconic politics and draconic relations and sort of interacting with it to bring its influence levels up and all of this sort of thing. And it was a really great kind of what I missed about Ludomancy until about halfway through the first week was how fascinating the world is. It's quite vaguely defined, and I think intentionally, but sort of you've got a world that is ostensibly it's the world in the 21st century, possibly a slightly sanitized version of the world because the game doesn't really want to deal with too many heavy topics, but national borders are roughly where they are in real life. You know, the global economy is roughly what it is in real life, etc. But magic exists. There's a sport involving magic, which is watched by millions across the globe and has fans from both the magical and non-magical community. There are magical beasts around the place. And that leaves a load of questions unanswered. Like, how has this impacted the world? You know, why are magicians not in charge? Is there sort of some sort of ministry of magic? Oh, in fact, I take that back. There is a ministry of magic, but its powers are sort of little defined. Is it part of the official government? Is it a sort of separate paragovernment organization? And that gave a fantastic space to explore and really dig into the lore. And I think once we had that first initial narrative hook from Peter, you know, we were off, we were really playing in that lore. And there were parts of the second week where the matches almost felt like an irritating interruption into this sort of exciting journey we were going on through uncharted territory, almost helping to be a part of mapping out, because I think Control were very willing, which really was great, Control were very willing to sort of allow us to be creative as well, allow us to sort of suggest plot elements and have them become part of the world's lore as well. As you can tell from my very excited monologue, yeah, I love the quest mechanic. I don't think we played the quest mechanic at all mechanically optimally, but, you know, in a way, A, that wasn't the fun way to play it, and B, I think actually in the end, sort of having gone through quite a few quests and having gotten very little back mechanically, near the end of the game, Peter rewarded us by just giving us a whole extra Ludomancy arena for free, which wasn't something we'd really even expected or been hinting at, but which was a really nice big mechanical reward for all of the effort we put in. So again, props to Peter for that sort of creativity in finding an appropriate reward for the quests we'd done.
That's awesome. I'm really keen to see some more of those emerging stories that we would have missed on our individual teams. I know that we had a few not so grand, because I think it took me a little bit longer as Hand to figure out how those quests could be used and what kind of mechanic they were. But in retrospect, I feel the questing was kind of like the most traditional mega gaming mechanic that I interacted with in my experience. And to be fair, I didn't interact with a lot, but it did feel like a classic freeform going and exploring and impacting the game world.
Yeah. Just to throw in as well, I think one suggestion I made in game feedback and I'd make again is that I think the game would really have benefited from a played news media team. I think there were a number of teams who, like yourself, Pat, didn't really have the opportunity to realize what quests' potential were. You know, there were some teams out there doing amazing quests, and sort of very, very final turn, we suddenly discovered that one of the teams, I forget which, had built an entire moon base, which was awesome. But I feel like there was a lot of stuff that had happened to lead up to that point, and in a way, having a sort of, there was the in-game Twitter where teams could sort of post out tweets of, here's what we've accomplished. And obviously Moonbase team had decided to keep things under wraps for whatever reason, or maybe just hadn't thought to tweet it out. But yeah, I could see some real benefits to an in-game news media team with sort of a mixture of blogging and tweeting rights to start to socialize some of those quest impacts, socialize some of that narrative. And for the teams who haven't been given a narrative hook themselves for whatever reason, or they have, but they haven't felt able to engage with it, maybe one of the other plots that's going on draws them in and they want to get involved in that. And then sort of quests start to be more than just a sort of mechanical exchange of resources for that team as well.
Yeah. And I think to put that on two, kind of divide that into two different responses. One of them is definitely like from a mega gaming perspective, there probably could have been a little bit more kind of lead up for a lot of the other teams. So a lot of I think some of the stuff that you were discussing, Ed, was actually like pretty, from my perspective, pretty back and forth in terms of the amount of like creativity that was coming out of those quests. So yeah, a lot of it was saying like, all right, you know, Peter might have said, okay, there's a dragon, what do you do? And then, you know, the rest of the team kind of being like, oh, what if we did all these other things? And then kind of bringing in the other dragon teams or teams with dragons to also discuss that further. And so I think that there probably needs to be some more of those like narrative hooks more structurally designed for other teams that may not be throwing in as much of that, and then having them decide, you know, do they want to pursue this path? Do they not? And then the other half with the news media is kind of, you know, we provided a little bit of news media with Peter writing a lot of the blog posts, kind of highlighting some of those items. But yeah, definitely having someone who's like true dedication is just, okay, here's everyone's press releases for various things, you know, like you had alluded to, Blackpool was the team that built a moon base. You know, they made their own PR release note for a lot of the different things they were doing, including the moon base. And it was kind of hard to try and keep that up with the amount of data that's coming in, you know, the amount of tweets that people were coming in with. So I think having someone, even if it's not a player, but like a control, that's their exclusive job, might certainly be impactful.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, with just yourself and Peter for the bulk of the game running control, it was amazing how much content you guys were able to produce, alongside, you know, all of the in-person moderation, all of the interactions with players, and all of the actual administration of the game. But yeah, I think, again, for a future game, I would probably veer away from such a heroic commitment and try and draft in another control or two.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm really curious, Stefan, to what extent did the narrative elements of the game take you by surprise? Was it always your intent and hope that people would start to explore the narrative in the world, or were you really just sort of expecting to run a sports game and have that be it?
I think that's an interesting question. I definitely wanted there to be, I kind of took it the same way that I would take a lot of my D&D sessions, in that I wanted to build a world but allow the players to decide what part of the world they wanted to explore. So just putting in enough about understanding, you know, the bare bone aspects of magic that you need to understand the game, and then the game itself, right? Because we're not playing football, soccer, basketball, you know. I think the narrative aspect required a little bit of understanding what, you know, one, what the sport looks like in the world, but also using that to just understand the game itself, right? And what that means within the world. So I think it's a mix of, you know, I'm definitely surprised and delighted at the amount of content folks were making, but it was also a really up to the players to decide to do that. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And incidentally, that is a genuine mega gaming tip for anyone. The more exciting the plot you offer control is, the more they're likely to run with it. So without wanting to metagame too hard, you can definitely get a lot of control's attention by doing something exciting and left field, which looks like it's going to have entertaining consequences. And there was certainly a certain amount of that going on for us.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's awesome to hear about some of these stories, because we had an indirect understanding of what was going on, but nowhere near this kind of thing. I had no idea that a moon base was even in the equation. So that's awesome. I think maybe a thing we struggled with at some points is that with having a team that is in a different time zone to most of the players, we did miss the opening ceremonies, as we said, and weren't able to make it to a lot of similar meetings like that with players. And at some stages, that did end up with the sensation, and we knew that going in, of course, and that's not a problem with the game, it's just an inherent fact of time zones. But that did lead to some instances where it felt a bit like being on the other side of a mirrored glass or something, you know? Like, I think at some stages we weren't totally sure what the spirit of the game was. Like with the villainous stuff, you know what I mean? It's like, is being a villainous team part of the spirit of the game or not? You know, like there were some instances, I think, where we struggled with that because of the time zone issue.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that's definitely one of the gifts and curses to take a take a bit of the mechanics from the game, of playing in 2 week sprints like this, is that the 2 weeks obviously allow you to have, you know, players like yourself and Ed, even, you know, players all across the world to be able to collaborate like that. But obviously with the problem that it's just not, you know, there will be a there will be interactions really with the amount of players that that are most populous, right? So, you know, the population was simply just more significantly American based, and therefore just kind of ended up being reflective of that, unfortunately. And I think there's just, you know, benefits, but then also problems, just like you're mentioning, Jack.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the real thing is this issue of like the spirit of the game, you know, which is like this kind of weird effervescent thing that comes from everyone interacting, which you can't necessarily communicate in text as well, you know. And if you do, obviously the advantage of an in-person mega game is that spirit of the game is all pervasive. Like everyone gets caught up in it and it's very immediate.
And I'll say real quick, I think that, you know, especially for the first run, I certainly felt hesitant with any sort of skullduggery in that aspect, you know, like kind of seeing like rigged matches and things like that. You know, there was definitely a concern that those things could sour actions, especially when you see the amount of time players were taking in like making their lineups and things like that. I wanted to give those folks the ability to say like, all right, well, I'm making those plans, and either I win them or not. I think future games, you know, one, I don't know how much the 2 week sprint might continue, but I think also a shorter time commitment would probably allow for a bit more freedom in that aspect in terms of, you know, being villainous or being not so.
I think you're absolutely right. Sorry, I've kind of jumped in. You're absolutely right that in hindsight, obviously, the 2 weeks, it sort of it heightened everyone's emotional engagement almost to an unhelpful level. But yeah, it's sort of, you do need to be very, very careful when allowing those sort of, especially invisible villainous actions. There's certainly room for people to be overtly villainous, you know, propose bills that quite flagrantly benefit their team, and then kind of try and do secret horse trading to get other people to vote for them or whatever. I think invisible villainy is always very dangerous in mega games. Stuff like, oh, you know, we rigged the match, and there was no way the other team could even have known until it was all over. Stuff that people have no way of countering tends to leave a bad taste in people's mouths.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that we really saw in our online mega game experiment with Dark and Stormy Night. There was a lot, like it was very much built into the game that there could be actions taken behind the scenes, and it encouraged that kind of play, which isn't for everyone. I wanted to move us over to the last sort of little mini part of the game, which I think was worth talking about, and I guess it's really a conversation about the economy of the game. But the contracts and the trades that the hands were involved in getting new magicians into their teams, I found this very interesting, especially like sort of starting the game with a blind like pretty much what was a blind auction, and then learning through experience, and in our case, failure to get new contracts, learning through that over the coming turns, you know, what money and other resources were actually worth in the game. Stefan, how did you expect all of that kind of economics of the game to go during design?
Yeah, absolutely. Like one of the things that really surprised me, I think, was the amount of trading that was going on at the start. Definitely, I think there was, you know, the free agents or the folks that aren't assigned to a team at the beginning of the match of the season were certainly going to be a big deal, as is typical with a lot of fantasy sports games. But I was really surprised at the amount of trading and internal team deals that were happening, mostly because I think that there's often a lot of rules that protect against that in a lot of fantasy sports games, for both good and bad, I think. But it was interesting to see it play out at such a level. In terms of the money, it was interesting, but I was kind of it kind of gave the sense to me, and also why I kind of went with the okay, everyone's going to start with the same money, because that kind of evened out the playing field of like, well, what is this player worth to you, right? In the real world, obviously some teams are just have more money than others, so they can throw more money at other players. But this was kind of like the soft salary cap, if you will, is that like you can't really feel bad that a team spent a lot of money, because all of us have the same amount of money. It's not like, you know, if you're the New York Yankees and it's like, oh, that team just has infinite money that they can throw at players.
Yeah, what was fascinating to me about the very early bits of the game, and honestly I loved the early game, but I get the impression that some people struggle with it a little, was that there was a lot of trading taking place in that gray period of the first day or three, when legitimately no one really knew what any player was worth. Like, we had a vague sense that big numbers were good. But I was finding, even sort of towards the start of the second week, some players were commenting, you know, oh, we need to do something about it in Parliament. Players with high hearts and low stars just aren't worth having. And, you know, we were sort of within our individual team chat, sort of looking at our roster where we'd intentionally sacrificed players with high star counts to get players with high hearts and massively benefited from it. And sort of, yeah, I love games economies with unclear definitions of value. I love trading in a setting where there's an unclear definition of value. It makes for some fantastic interactions. But I think it did also very much create a first come, first served context. We very quickly landed on what we thought was a good definition of value for players. We swooped in and made some early trades with teams who had landed on a slightly different definition of value or just hadn't really settled theirs. And we did get away with some very valuable players for quite low prices. And I think that definitely, as much as, you know, our Sage worked very hard picking our lineups for individual matches, but I think that's a massive part of our victory. And it meant that in some ways, the sort of teams did settle into sort of top tier and second tier teams by about day four.
Yeah. And I'll say definitely ahead of time that also, as a quick note, that I think that I probably didn't do as great of a job at giving those soft like definitions of player salaries specifically, right? Because a lot of them started a lot lower and just closer together. So like one star magicians kind of were within the same wheelhouse as five star magicians, which kind of just doesn't make sense. And probably, you know, led to some people thinking, well, you know, how much are folks going to be paying for this person? Are they going to be paying, you know, within that same realm, or are they really going to, you know, spend all their money on getting people?
Yeah, so there's sort of two points that I wanted to touch on there. One was that something that Stefan mentioned briefly was this sort of inter-team trading. There was a period there where ourselves and another team were doing quite frequent player swaps between us for a match or two to try and work out the best team that we could between the two matches and our roster. It didn't work out so well for us. I'm not sure if it worked out particularly well for the other team either. And I think that was in part because of something that Ed touched on, which was we sort of missed out on the first round of bidding, had some numbers that came out of the first round of bidding, tried to use those numbers to sort of direct what the next round of bidding or like the value of players were, but the value of players spiked because all the teams that missed out in the first round of bidding all of a sudden were at a deficit compared to the other teams, and so suddenly good free agents were at a premium, and it turned out that very, very quickly players were just being were being priced at what we would have thought a day or two ago was completely unreasonable, and it ended up being something where you'd flick over somebody else's team and go, oh, they've got that player for like that little money, or you flick over and you go, oh, they're paying like almost triple or four times the amount that I would have expected for something of that value. And it ended up being feeling difficult when there was a team that you looked at and you're like, okay, obviously these players were picked up in the first round of bidding because no way would you have ever got something that cheap normally or at this current period of time.
It was really interesting. We were recording stuff of our impressions as we went through this game, and you can hear us driving ourselves absolutely bonkers over this question of how much is a dollar worth, like, because we never found out. Like, basically, you start out the game with 400 million, but you don't know how much income you're going to get over the course of the game, or at least we did. So we had no idea. Maybe we get $200 million tomorrow, right? Or maybe we get 1 million, like, who knows? So we didn't know that. And then also something we'll probably talk about going on down the track as well is that we discovered that some teams believed that their money was going to carry over completely to the next season. So they were playing as if their starting money needed to last them for the next three seasons, which is... So teams had very wildly different definitions of what the dollar was worth, which was really interesting. And also, it was wild to see a lot of the spikes. Some teams ended up with one player who was worth $101 million, and some teams had a five-star player for $10 million. Like, it was really wild.
Yeah. And that's huge, especially like I feel like the legacy mechanics, or at least understanding of the legacy mechanics, probably could have also been clearer. And I think that all of those things kind of show themselves in kind of the difficulties that we're all talking about, right? Like understanding what a dollar is worth, but also what a player is worth, with a limited pool, but a pool that's big enough that, you know, there are, you know, behind the scenes, there's 300 magicians and theoretically could be more. So you really have no idea of what, you know, how to moneyball all of this.
I have to say, with that conversation about the starting money and the level footing and the mystery around what money was worth, I think the most nefarious thing I actually did in the game was subtly work into one of my negotiations a suggestion that we had way more money than we did, because I thought it was going to be a weird flex, and maybe we'd at least play some mind games with some other teams. But
that's huge.
That's the most nefarious thing you did all game, then you're going pretty good.
Once we were told we were meant to play nice, we played nice, I swear.
One thing I want to mention before we move off the money subject is halfway through, this shows also how out of our depth I was, at least. Halfway through the game, I was like, hold on, we've been buying players, but we haven't lost any money. How does that work? And we discovered that money is only taken out at the very end of the season. So you can spend as much money as you want and you won't lose any money until the very end of the mega game. And at that point, we devised a strategy which I called the go big or go bankrupt approach, where it's like, we'll just spend every set of money we have. And if we go bankrupt, but we lose the championship, then we won the championship. Like, that's it. So, which obviously completely failed for us, of course, but you know.
I wanted to move us over just before we get into the nitty-gritty of that whole next season question. I wanted to start, just have a quick look at the mixing of genres with this game. Stefan, it's a mix of mega game and fantasy online sport. I wanted to ask you, really, was it difficult in the design process to balance those two, or were you leaning into one more than the other?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I felt like from a design perspective that I had to be very pointed or specific with the way that I blended those genres together. I think I mentioned last time that, you know, part of the reason I switched to... Yeah, I'll start with the game first, right? So I didn't want to do football or a game that people had known, because I think that there are inherent difficulties in designing around the like game aspect of that. So with that being said, there's like a difficulty of trying to make, you know, there'll be just a set of expectations that are built into that. And also a set of difficulties that I can't play around, right? So it's like the rules of football are that there's always, you know, you always get 6 points for a touchdown and you always get X points. And a lot of that also just isn't easily manipulatable for that mega game aspect. So if I wanted to do a sports game in a mega game, then I felt like I had to make a new sport. After that, I had to then try and find justification for kind of broader aspects of it. So that's where the fantasy part came in, and trying to be able to give folks a sense of like, all right, well, there's magic, so really anything could happen. And using that to the advantage of, I think, to like what Ed was pointing out, just this idea of how do we explore this world in a way that is a bit more unique than standard sports. So each one of those aspects was needed from my perspective to get the information across to the players at, you know, all at once, especially because when I tried this a year ago, that was one of the major difficulties, was that players were not able to grasp the rules. And that was at a time when the game was a lot closer to a lot more esports and games that were already kind of visible in the video game space. And I was playing with a lot of video gamers and they still were not really like grasping the rules, because I was making like all of these, I was making even more complicated like terminology and new ideas that some people were grabbing, some people weren't. So it really, I leaned heavily on the fantasy aspect to give some grounding, at least on understanding this whole new thing.
And how did the players receive the game as far as the design split goes? Because I know that when I signed up for the game, I was not expecting exactly what it was as far as a fantasy sports goes. And then once we had our last chat, the previous episode where we talked about it, I had a whole new view of what the game was going to be like. Yeah. How did players, did you find, what's the feedback been like on that split between traditional, you know, quote, end quote, mega games and a fantasy online sports game?
Yeah, I think that probably should have been something I had asked from a survey perspective. In terms of expectations, I think they fell in line similarly to what you would see from mega games, is that some people really got super invested in every aspect of the game and tried to disassemble everything from all sides. And some folks were either, you know, trying to focus in on their portion of the game, or not necessarily want to get into the bigger side so that they have a bit of a surprise. So in terms of expectation, I think there probably is a little bit of more upfront information that I could provide, or provide at least for the ancillary part, so that folks that want to get involved can. And I think, to like we were saying before, legacy mechanics is definitely one of those aspects. But I think there was a pretty standard blend of folks who were, you know, really into everything that was happening, and being surprised that like, oh, there's a moon base now, or that sort of, you know, out of left field mega game aspect.
Well, I think that's probably a pretty good segue to go in and talk about the legacy element of this game. This was something that I think our team missed the announcement about early on. So we actually discovered that the game was supposedly or possibly going to be a legacy game a little bit later down the track. Did you want to just talk us through, Stefan, what legacy means, I suppose, and how it's going to apply to the Owl League, if you know, and if you can tell us?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in the broadest and most pointed aspect of legacy, it really, to me, meant that, you know, your records and the team rosters were definitely going to be the part that carry over from season to season. And so storylines with, say, magicians who are maybe bad one season and then really train themselves to be incredible next season and become the hero of their team, those are the kind of things I wanted to carry over. Of course, along with the teams, right? So that teams that are, you know, 1-7 this year could next year be the champions, right? Because, oh, they figured out something preseason that, or they figured out something that will allow them to be much better at the in the next season. And same with like just those storylines that you would see from normal sports, right? Can the Cardiff Dragons keep their championship run into the next season? Does that look, you know, or are they going to disband their entire team so that they can earn more money, or like free up more money for something else? Like, those are the kind of questions that I wanted to allow for with creating a legacy aspect. So one, records, two, team rosters. The difficulty, I think, was in kind of where that those weird middle grounds were with what does it mean for money? What does it mean for like in other in-game resources that are more viscous, you know?
One aspect I'm really interested to see how you handle is the introducing of new players into the legacy format. By the end of the first game, obviously, the bulk of players from the first season had a pretty good grasp of Ludomancy, had existing strategies. Quite a lot of us had quite extensive spreadsheets, and I think someone even wrote their own app just to work out winning strategies for a game. And the fear would be that new players diving into Owl League Season 2 would just find themselves unable to compete with all that existing infrastructure. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts yet about what you might do to combat that.
Yeah, I mean, there'll definitely be player retirement in that aspect. So there'll be players that certainly won't make it to the next season, you know, due to age, due to some sort of story reasoning. The other aspect of that kind of I want to hope to introduce is one, some more game balancing mechanics. So that's just kind of a broader thought and discussion, but the other half being players, mega game players that interact with magicians in a different way. So kind of like the introduction of agents, or, you know, folks that represent magicians as a player character, so that there is a little bit more, like, it's not just this amorphous person. These player characters have the hopes and dreams of all these magicians. So like, maybe this magician really, you know, this magician is from Busan, so they really want to try and be a part of the Busan team. Or there's reasons outside of just straight money that a player might want to play somewhere else.
That sounds awesome. I'll be honest. I think that kind of narrative depth is exciting, to appealing to me. What I was going to ask was kind of on the flip side of what Ed said. Rather than having new players arriving in future games, how do you have any plans to specifically balance having players opt out of this first game who weren't really playing for Legacy, so to speak, people who don't intend to stick around?
Yeah, and that part I think is trickier, right? From a broad perspective, you know, I think we're allowing all of the teams to basically have their opt-in choice, which is to say either, hey, would you want to keep your team and play next season? And even the possibility of saying, hey, you know, this, they might not be able to play next season when it happens, and but you still want to keep your team, so maybe we would like archive the team effectively. And so a couple of people were even suggesting, like, what happens in the Premier League, where there are teams that go down to the minors and then can earn their way up. I think we would probably allow for something a bit more fluid, where we would just say, okay, this team is not going to be a part of the league this year. So we can kind of like archive that team for when that group of players can come back, and then introduce a new team into the lineup. But really, you know, if they don't want to do it, then that would allow for some other, you know, new management to come in and take over that team. And then kind of a lot there, I think there's a lot of mechanical levers that IS Control can be able to move, so that it's not just, you know, the Cardiff Dragons are going to win every championship because their team is already set up from season one, from day one, to succeed. So,
yeah, awesome. That's good to hear. That was definitely one of the things I was really interested in hearing, because it seemed like, you know, if hypothetically we really drove the Quebec Nine Stars into the ground and ended up with a terrible team, it would be pretty terrible for a new player to walk in and go, hey, yeah, sorry, you have to start the game with an awful team because the last players to take him were just awful.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's while having different like levels of teams is good, certainly you know, acquiring a team that where the previous owners like drove them into the ground, you know, and I think there are some real life teams that we probably could all point to that do this today, but that certainly wouldn't be fun as a player, for sure.
I suppose the question for me on that is, I expected to go into this sort of conversation about the Legacy stuff as a hypothetical, but it kind of sounds like there's a lot of work, or at least mental work, already happening on it. Is it a sure thing that we're going to see more seasons of our league?
That's my hope. I think that there was enough positive feedback from the game that I think that it's, for me at least, it's worth trying to bring back and, you know, continue to work on. A lot of the things that I've been pointing out were aspects of the game that I might have originally thought, and were, you know, by setting a time of like, okay, we're going to play it this summer, deciding, okay, those aspects I need to like work on later, so we'll introduce them at a different time. So those are things that I hope to work on for the next seasons. And really, I think it'll be a question of when and how much time we'll be able to get to make this happen. Yeah.
So I'd certainly, yeah, say you've got a quality game here that bears repeating. And I'd also encourage you that even if some of the challenges of the Legacy format specifically end up making future games a little more like we're just starting from scratch, and a little less like continuing the narrative and the teams from where they left off, that would be a bit of a shame. But honestly, like, I would also be up for a wipe the board, start clean with 18 new teams that have been invented from scratch. I could see, you know, the game itself is fun. The legacy aspect would be awesome to see, but is not needed for the game to continue.
Yeah, and there was something that I wanted to also kind of allow for if we were playing things out of season. So like this would be the Premier League, if you will, and it's like these teams are the best of the best. But maybe if we played it at a convention, let's say at you know, Shucks, where it's in Vancouver, maybe it's all local Vancouver teams that we design, and those are the teams that they play, so that there can allow for a small amount of legacy by having just different sets, but then they're completely new magicians, new player bases, that sort of thing.
I did have a question, because the legacy side of things really does interest me. It's something that I like the sound of, but I was really unsure as to how things would work. And so you've made it a little bit clear here, but in terms of continuing on, would it be something where you would wipe the slate clean, as in, would we start again with new, fresh teams now that everyone knows what's going on?
Right. That part I'm still trying to decide. I think so. You know, one of the things I'll mention now is that, like, we're shooting to play a variant or some aspect of this game as a part of the Mega Game Coalition convention, and that won't be, you know, obviously that won't be 2 weeks because the convention doesn't go that long. But I think that I don't want to tie every instance of the Owl League to legacy, because I think to all of those points that everyone is making, there's a difficulty and potential like unbalancing that could happen on a broader scale. That certainly would just be easier by just saying reset, but allowing also for some sort of narrative reason for why that reset is occurring. So like I was saying, you know, maybe this is just a local set of Ludomancy teams, or this is a different cup, if you will. So this is like maybe the Federation Cup, or I think one team already suggested in Parliament the Prospero Cup, which would be a completely different format, maybe round robin with all the teams, and you know, really play in the tournament space in terms of what could be possible for other seasons or other instances of play.
Yeah, I think you've got endless opportunities as soon as you sort of commit to a legacy game. But I think I agree with Ed as well. There's definitely, you know, there's a game here as it is that's got a lot of replayability in its design. One of the last things that I wanted to delve into was, I guess, some of the role play and the politics of this game. It was pretty in depth, and there was sort of, we kind of touched on it earlier, I felt a different kind of overload from this game, in that I wasn't strapped for time the way that I am in, you know, a live action mega game, a 6 hour affair or eight hours or whatever. But I was, I did struggle to find time to read everything because there were so many conversations going in, so many channels, and it was very difficult to, if I didn't have much time, to figure out what was most important to me and how to get, you know, all that information digested. But one thing that did become evident was people got very, very into it. So I wanted to ask you, did you expect this kind of in-depth role play and politics in this type of game, or were you expecting a pretty more casual mega game experience?
Yeah, I don't know. Part of my expectation coming in was either people will love it and get super in depth with it, or people will, you know, bounce off of it and it'll be very, you know, it'll be like pulling teeth trying to get people involved. So I think, honestly, like everything else, it was probably a mix, that there were some teams and some folks that were getting really invested and some folks that weren't. And, you know, I think with anything, that probably is the case. But I don't know if I expected the level of intensity that the, you know, different groups were getting into, both good and bad, right? Like the fact that folks were really getting invested in the lore of ludomancy and getting into the, like, you know, what does it mean on a greater scale of how the game should work and how people, how fans, right, how non-existent people would feel about different aspects of the game were very interesting to me.
Mm. And with the asynchronous nature and the online nature, there were so many different people from around the world involved. Yeah. I know that we weren't the only Australians playing, and then there's obviously players from the UK, players from the US. I don't know if you're aware of any other time zones or continents.
Yeah, I think we had a team from the Philippines that were there too. Oh, right. So they were maybe a few hours closer than you all. But yeah, it was a wide range that, you know, partly I was hoping for because we would allow for this 2-week stint. But certainly I don't know if I grasped the difficulty or the amount of difficulty that might lead to other teams, you know.
Mm. And I mean, beyond the obvious, where time frames mean that, you know, where we were asleep when a lot of key things and discussions were happening, or we had to get up early for deadlines, which was fine, you know. That just comes with this new world of mega gaming, which is pretty exciting to explore. But aside from the literal differences, did you encounter, or I suppose this is for everyone, do you encounter any culture clashes or culture shocks in this game, dealing suddenly playing with people from overseas? Did you see any sort of different mega game cultures that were evident?
I would be interested to hear what you all have to say with that. And from my perspective, I think that there are... It's hard for me to say how much of it is like cultural to a region or, a place, as opposed to just there are some people who are certain types of players. And kind of the heart of mega gaming allows for such a wide array of those types of players, both in play type, but in like, you know, play style. I don't know how to describe that portion, but like kind of how they approach the game, I think, to what you're alluding to.
Yeah, I'd second a lot of that. I think there's a far greater disparity in just level of mega game experience and how that impacts people's play styles than there is in sort of any particular nationality or culture and how that seems to impact people's play styles. There are a lot of we have this discussion in the UK mega gaming scene not infrequently that Americans play mega games really weird. I think a lot of it does just boil down to a lot of the UK mega gaming scene. You go to a UK mega game, there's going to be someone there who's attended like 30 plus mega games, just right. Guaranteed, usually a good third of the room. And obviously that has a massive impact on how the mega game turns out. Like you run in the UK, actually we run a mega game at a con, which tends to attract mostly new players. You get very much the same set of behaviors that we look at happening in American games and go, those weirdos. So I think, yeah, actually my finding is, yeah, people approach mega games pretty similarly the world over. They maybe have some different sort of cultural biases around how sports teams might be managed and specific cultural artifacts like that. But in general, it's, the big changes in behavior you get are just with the level of experience people have of mega gaming as a hobby.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think that for me, it seemed like the time zones really did affect folks in both like subtle and not so subtle ways. You know, like if I look at some of the conversations that were happening, say with Parliament, right? So there's the simple aspect of, like you were saying, Patrick, that, you know, you just might not be there in the space when certain meetings happen, but also folks that, you know, are part of different time zones that might be joining meetings with like 2 a.m. brain, right? Or, you know, 7 a.m. brain. And I think that, you know, from the outside looking in, kind of can be looked at as like, well, we're all online, we're all here at the same time, so we all should be on the same footing, where sometimes I think some emotions or some sets of feelings, and especially because we're online and not in person, you can't get to see the person react. I think that those two aspects were huge in that regard. I think more so than I initially thought.
Definitely. As a person who was in Parliament, there were a few moments where things seemed to get very heated, which I wasn't involved in and didn't understand the context of, which I would kind of wander in on and go, oh, I wonder what this argument is about. So I think the biggest difference I noticed was in just that level of investment, I guess, is that because it's run over 2 weeks, there's a huge variable in how much time each person can put in the game, right? You can either check it in for 10 minutes and just submit your turn, or you could be refreshing this app and checking out Discord right. every moment. And I think there was a huge difference between players there, which resulted in very different kind of communication styles, I guess.
There is something distinct about sort of stepping into a conversation that's already happened, effectively just reading through the text versus sort of being in it as it's happening and wanting to contribute and sort of wanting to steer it, for better or for worse. Like, and I think, you know, some of the conversations that were fine at the time may have looked more heated afterwards, and vice versa. Right. It's a very weird social dynamic that I think many of us haven't really explored.
Right, and explored in this specific way, right? We, you know, most mega games have a council game, and certainly deal with much more intense topics than, you know, Wizards playing sports. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And certainly they don't. You know, there's a level of emotion that is both hard to read and hard to evaluate. For various people, right? So it'll look different for everyone, and I think that's the part that was really tricky online, and you know, certainly has to be for me more thought through, I think.
Yeah, I think it's gonna be interesting to see how the way that people approach that conundrum changes over the next, you know, into the future, I suppose, because these things are becoming more and more frequent in this current state of play with mega games online. So we're going to be learning lots of lessons together as a happy international chummy community.
Yeah, definitely.
I think we might need to start wrapping up. I've taken up a lot of your time, and I appreciate you guys signing on in whatever time of day it is. I thought we could just sign out just by quickly saying each of us, you know, what was the best moment of the game, and what are you most interested in seeing in future iterations? Did you want to start us off, Stefan?
Sure. Yeah, I think most outwardly, definitely the championship and kind of those Saturdays where a lot of the folks were signed in, I think were pretty special, because you could see the interactions, especially day one, folks jumping right in, like you would expect in a in-person mega game, were really, really special to me. Internally, I think seeing all of the, you know, conversations that we're having today and seeing them play out from different teams and different perspectives, was really, you know, always the fun part, is that Discord allows you to read in on everyone's conversations and where people are arguing about what, where you wouldn't necessarily have that in person, like sitting in on every table that's playing, you know.
I think one of the best moments for me mechanically in game was when finally pursuing a little quest line, we got a star player who both had some personality that we could play with in game, and also it was just sort of the first moment that I felt like I was able to really positively impact the game. And I think prior to that point, I had thought, okay, this is all very mechanically light, so going through quests like this, trying to get a player out of it, probably a bit too optimistic for me. But yeah, that was definitely my key moment.
Yeah, so I think the best features of the game were, as we've discussed, the narrative side, which was really quite well done, And then also, I think that the technical side, the work that Control put into running the game, but also just the app itself and the videos was really, really well done. I would like to, convey my astonishments at how well it was actually presented. I think I wasn't expecting that level of expertise, and I was happily excited when I found out that it was presented so well.
Yeah, I'd say similar. I mean, obviously, it's hard not to just say, oh, well, the moment when we found out we'd won. But I really love the broadcasts that I think it was the Worcester Ravens team did, the guys from West Coast Mega Games. It was just an amazing bit of out of game creativity that they brought to the game that made it so much richer, completely unprompted as far as I could tell.
And that
was amazing, and obviously for the matches where they produced those casts, I think really enhanced the experience of having been part of them. So yeah, massive props to those guys. That must have taken a lot of time and effort to script and record.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, like you said, completely of their own volition and their own, you know, time commitment. So absolutely massive props and praise to them as well.
Definitely. On my side, I think my favorite moment was I managed to make a charitable foundation called Lux Splendida, which raised over 110 million. So that was nice. And we won the charitable award, which was good. The community service award, which was lovely. And for the next game, I'm most interested to see how the legacy mechanics pan out. I think that's a really, awesome and interesting mechanical way to do it. And I'm fascinated to see how it works.
Yeah, it'd be really cool to have a chat about that more in depth as it all starts to come together.
Definitely.
Well, thank you all. Stefan, did you have anywhere or anything to plug, anything coming up?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, we're going to try and run a variant or some form of the Owl League as a part of the Mega Game Coalition online conference that we're running hopefully in September, so not too long from here. Personally, a lot of stuff I'm hoping to design as a part of Magic Coffee House, my game design studio, one of them being a sci-fi space race kind of mega game, and then another one maybe not so mega gamey but kind of playing into a sort of large multiplayer haunted house storytelling sort of game over Discord. So using kind of Discord bots and using different tech from that side to try and convey a weird story, you know.
Cool. Awesome. And Ed, your corner of the Mega Game Verse.
So yeah, without wanting to jump any announcements, I'm gonna be controlling for at least one game in the online Mega Game Con that Stefan mentioned. So I guess, get into the Mega Game Coalition Discord if you haven't, or watch the Mega Game Coalition website for more info about that. I'm playing with a couple of Mega Game designs, but that's basically always true. There's nothing that's on the verge of landing or anything like that.
Yeah, awesome. And yeah, with the con, I believe that we'll be there as well if all things pan out. So looking forward to seeing what you guys deliver for that. Jack, Zach, from the home front, anything to plug?
Nothing crazy. I'll just say that the Brisbane Mega Game Facebook group is still the best place to check latest stuff from me out.
As Ed said, we've got, at least from my end, a couple of ideas bouncing around, but that's almost always the case. And we're looking forward to hopefully being able to run some stuff in person eventually.
Mm. Absolutely.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
That's the dream.
Yeah. Well, all right. A bit kind of, anyway, sorry.
We almost got there in Sydney, but anyway, another day. thank you guys. I really appreciate it, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Cheers.
You too. Thanks so much.
All right, that does it for this episode. Thanks again for listening, as always. We recently had a question from one of our listeners, David, from Brisbane Mega Games, talking about episode 9, where we gave a bit of a post-mortem on our online game, Dark and Stormy Night. David was asking whether or not the game designers, i.e. us, mostly Jack, had played Mafia via a forum or any other social deduction games. Jack, what have you got for that?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the key influences on the game, which we didn't mention in the podcast, was a game called Black Rock Outpost by David Harmon, who's an Australian designer. It's basically, it was very similar to Mafia Online, but with like a space theme. It was run through a website. Each day people would comment as different kind of space western pioneer characters and do all the things you normally do in a Mafia game and a social deduction game. So that was a huge influence. Absolutely. I haven't personally gotten too into online Mafia games myself, but huge fan of them in person.
Yeah, awesome. So as always, we were really down for hearing questions or comments that you've got. So do send them through. You can email us, you can comment on Facebook, or get in touch with us any other way. Jack, where can people find you?
Yeah, they can look me up on the Brisbane Mega Game Facebook group or on the website ashtowngames.com.
And as always, you can find me at the SydneyMegaGamers.com. And on our Facebook group and page, Sydney Maker Gamers. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.